Okay, comrades, we'll make a start then. My name is Kevin Parslow. I'm the convener of the Socialist Party Caucus in Unite, and we're discussing here today the fighting of witch hunts. Can right-wing unions be changed? And on that, so we have two speakers, both in a personal capacity, speaking from the experiences that they're going through in their unions. Our first speaker on your right is Glenn Kelly, who's a national executive member of Unison, but has been fighting the witch hunts as part of the four Socialist Party members who've been attacked in Unison and are appealing against suspensions from office for between 3 to 5 years. Glenn will speak first for 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll be followed by Chris Boff, again in personal capacity, the Assistant General Secretary of the PCS, who will go into the details of how, you know, we work inside unions where we have a important role in considering policy and so on, and whether, you know, other unions can follow the route that the PCS has followed. So, as I say, Glenn will start for about 15 to 20 minutes, Christopher will be next, and then we'll take questions and contributions from the floor. Glenn.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Comrades, when this session was being drafted, there were various titles for it, whether it was a question of a before and after it should be called, although I wondered whether it should be called the good, the bad, and then I thought it might be slightly insulting to the chair, and so we decided to go with that particular title. But as a public sector worker and someone elected to represent 800,000 council workers, you would rightly have thought that our union at this moment in time was in effect drawing up war plans to take on the councils and the local authorities. Because as we speak, every local authority in Britain is currently drawing up plans for the slaughter of literally tens and thousands of our members' jobs, are drawing up plans in some cases for the wholesale privatisation of every service they can get away with in a local authority. And therefore, as I said, you would have thought, because even they admit at the very tops of our union, no matter what the outcome of the general election, we are in for a time that we have not seen since the dark days of Thatcher. But unfortunately, the only war that the Unison leadership seem capable and willing to wage with any fervour is a waging a war on activists within the union, and in particular, and for no accident, the socialists and Trotskyists within our trade union. Over the last couple of years in Unison, although it has been a feature since its very formation, there has been literally bans, expulsions and the closing down of branches. There is literally a brutal regime that exists and that will stoop to levels that you would thought not even the employers would go to. And some of the examples of activists who've been expelled or banned from office are appalling. In Newcastle, we've had a situation where an activist has been expelled from the union. But it wasn't enough for the union to have him expelled from the union. The union also lost him his job to the point where he may, in effect, never work again. And despite the fact that it's turned out that an activist who gave evidence against him had several friends on Facebook belonging to groups like Stormfront and the British National Party, that she had direct links with some far-right organisations, when it came to the hearing, a full-time official sat next to her and supporting her, whilst another full-time official walked out the door and told the member and the socialist that he was no longer representing him. Or in the question of in Leeds at this moment in time, when a union activist was sacked for his union activities, the union said they were backing him, but the next day then said to him, well, now you're out of work, you no longer remember the executive because your membership has changed and took his membership and is of the national executive away from him. When he then re-stood, he won the election, turned up to the next executive to say, look, I got democratically elected, and they booted him out of the room and now are threatening to expel him from the union. Or even the depths that they'd go in London of a socialist activist who in effect, she was in hospital, about to have a baby and was taken quite seriously unwell, And when she was in hospital, because she was an agency worker at that point in time, or they thought, they said, oh, maybe her membership has lapsed, let's check if we can remove her from the membership list while she lay in a hospital bed. That is the depths to which some of these people will sink to. And in Newark, when the left, in East London, a branch in East London, when the left took control of that branch and won the elections, what did the bureaucracy do? A bit like the Lisbon elections, if you don't get it right first time, have another vote. Removed from office all those who had been elected and worked in hand with the employer, a Labour council in Newham, to put back in place all those who'd lost in their seats. And also recently, in the last week or so, we've just heard, and unfortunately some of these cases go on and you don't even know they're happening, of an activist who's just been banned for 8 years in Manchester because she had the temerity to write on behalf of the branch about a unemployed member to the local unemployed workers centre about whether they could provide her with any support. Unfortunately, on each and every one of those occasions, they are all either directly or connected with, because even if you're seen associated with socialists now, you're guilt by association. And the most recent one I've just heard, it goes back some time, of an activist who was threatened with action, in the end in disgust, resigned because he happened to, in a branch meeting, suggest that the NEC member who wanted to go for a meeting that lasted 2 hours in London wanted 3 days paid, costing the branch some £400. And because the activist in the meeting said, we shouldn't be paying for you to junk it around the union, was then threatened with disciplinary. It's now a disciplinary phrase, using the phrase junk it. Never mind, you might be robbing the union blind of their money. Accusing somebody now of junketing is even a disciplinary offence. And that is without, of course, any of the detail of the case that has been waged against us. And it's with some pride that we know that they will not have even finished their appeal process before our third year is entered into. Our case started in June 2007, and the earliest decision that they can get, in effect, is by January 2010. And we wear that with a badge of pride. Now, some in the left have made the mistake over the course of the last few years. Some proclaimed a few years ago after Prentice got elected that the witch hunt was over, there was no longer Bickerstaff, and that the witch hunt was gone. And we said it was a temporary truce at this moment in time, and when the moment arose, when it needed, they would be back. And of course, we've been proven correct. Some in the left said that it's not organised, it's not planned, it's a matter of accidental series of incidents. And that we, of course, pointed to the opposite. Now, during our recent court case, unfortunately for them, there's the occasional full-time unelected official who still has some principles, who released to us via court orders documents that shows that the level of organisation, well before our witch hunt started. In 2006, my regional officer was removed from my branch in discussions with the leading officer in the London region. Was told, and I quote from his grievance that he lodged at the time, he says, Linda, and that's the London Regional Secretary, the same person who did the preliminary investigation into our case, Linda made it clear that there'd been a firm decision that the problems posed by Glen Kelly's political loyalties needed someone fresh. And further on had said that there were hotspot branches that had to be dealt with who put politics before the union. This is a woman who has never been near a ballot box since the formation of Unison. A woman who's paid £50,000 a year of our members' money, but yet decides that they think that they can organise to remove elected branch officers. And in May 2008, after our case had started, on a 2-day training course of all the London officials in the London region, and in Unison that's a hell of a lot of them that there are, all unelected of course, they had a 2-day training course, and when one of the officers, this particular officer, Tom Snow, courageously, still an employee, although retired in a couple of months, has come out and given evidence in court for. When in effect, it was became clear, he said, that the purpose of the second day court was in effect about dealing with the socialists in the union. And he quotes the same London regional secretary. He says that your statement that dealing with the problem of Trotskyist activists was indeed part of the course, expectation of the course, and that should have been made clear to officers. They think it's perfectly legitimate to sit and plan who the officers that they should or shouldn't remove from this trade union. It is planned and organised in the same correspondence. When he challenged it, she said, in effect, that they'd got their orders from the very top. The unit headquarters, only a matter of a few hundred yards away from this particular building. And it has been organised and orchestrated with the talents of the dark arts of the CP and the Stalinists inside Unison, many now who are full-time national officers, using their well-trained arts of the past, alongside the talents, or not a case, of the Labour Party, New Labour, Blairites, and those who also hone their skills on the witch hunts, on militants themselves. And it does pose, of course, the question for all of us, in all of the trade unions, because it would be a mistake to think that somehow Unison is an aberration. It is the most extreme, in my opinion, at this moment in time in Britain. But it is not an aberration, and nor is it an issue that will not land at the doorsteps of many other activists and socialists in other trade unions. But the reality is, behind this, is in effect a political question of why this arises. For many of the national trade union leaders in our trade union, and of the national officers, for them, in effect, particularly because of their close links with the CP or hangers-on for them, they now, since the collapse, and we're celebrating the anniversary of the Berlin Wall being brought down, is in effect, from that point in reality, they have abandoned the idea that trade unions have any role to play in changing of society, abandoned the question that socialism is at all possible. And for them now, in effect, the market is as good as we can get, and in effect, New Labour is as good as we can get, and they've reduced their role now to literally managing decline. The whole debate in ties our trade union often is not about whether you can fight redundancies, but in effect how you can ameliorate them, what workers' rights are, etc. Unison have just produced a very good legal pack on what are your rights for redundancy. But unfortunately, in a bulletin that's about this thick, there isn't a paragraph about organising and fighting against them. It's all about the consequences after the event, and that is literally what they've reduced themselves for. That the membership, in effect, are passive. We're supposed to rely on the so-called talents and skills of our negotiators, who are already, in many cases, on the issue, for instance, of our pension. Our national officers are already talking about us having to give up some of our terms and conditions further again in order to keep it. They are waving a white flag of surrender on cuts before the battle has even started. And of course, it is no accident that they are going for socialists within trade unions. They fear those who can articulate the anger and desperation of members. Those who can articulate the anger and desperation at New Labour. Those who literally know that why is it a case that we are handing £3 million a year of our members' money to New Labour for the same time that it is attacking us. And it was no accident that this year's, what's in effect an internal Labour Party conference inside Unison, the Unison Labour Link conference, that Prentice gave a warning to that conference unless they could shift Labour. He warned and pointed to the NEC elections and about the six members of the Socialist Party who had been elected. He feels the heat that we reflect, in effect, from the mass of the membership in their opposition to New Labour, knows that he has to take some steps to try and cut across it. And also, what they know is that they don't have an alternative for leadership. It is frightening, to be quite honest with you, to sit on the national executive of our union and see how many of them struggle to put a sentence together, let alone a political sentence. It's like being, at times, in the worst council meeting when you cringe about how poor councillors are in terms of their lack of ideas, and they don't have a layer to base themselves on the top. They've even now, these people are the elected leadership of the union, and they're now complaining, why have the left got all the best speakers, and that we're now setting up leadership training courses for our national executive members. Because, in effect, they are creatures who have been developed, given positions off the back of no background, having done no little or no work, and of course, no politics. And in that climate, socialists pose a very dangerous threat to them. It is literally a case of, we better get them before they get us, because we pose a threat to their positions of power and privilege. With the likes of Prentice, who talks about low paid, and yet he earns £137,000 a year of our members' money, when his own average wage of his own members are just £20,000. What does he know of the lives of ordinary public sector workers so distant? When most of the national officers have never, frankly, been activists, many of them, straight out of universities and straight through the college schemes or the schemes of the TUC, who frankly themselves behave more like ACAS inside the union when it comes to defending our members. And they know that we pose a threat to their positions of power and privilege. And they've looked over their shoulder at the PCS. They saw what the PCS position was, in effect, and they saw what has happened, and they fear that position. Despite the smiling pictures of Swatka and Prentice in our magazine in last week about this new memorandum of understanding, I tell you, inside the executive, the memorandum is in effect, we hate the PCS, and they will openly attack the PCS, despite what bits of paper they sign behind the scenes. As Bill referred to it, it might be a truce in preparing for war, because that is, in effect, their future that they fear and see before them of the left and the socialists taking place. And the final area I want to deal with, really, is the question of our campaign. Why is it the question that, in effect, nearly 3 years on, and they still haven't got us, when for many others, frankly, they're already down the road, out the door, without even a whisper being raised? And that is because, first and foremost, our party saw this as an attack on our party and our ideas and responded collectively. Our history of fighting witch hunts of the 80s gave us an enormous head start. Peter Taft now bemoans the fact that we've lasted longer than the editorial board of the militant being expelled from the Labour Party. Unfortunately, it's a record we've even taken from him. But all of that experience of knowing that you cannot fight a witch hunt quietly. Unfortunately, some of the left and socialist activists, many of them members of the so-called United Left, have failed to demonstrate that they can protect their own members. Who thought naively that there would be a sense of justice and fairness inside the disciplinary hearing. Surely the facts would tell that I'm not guilty of anything, and honestly believe that that would happen. And Unison has done what we warned that they would do. Is in effect, they want to take our members into a corner, the activists into a dark corner, give them a little kicking away from the whole of the membership. We immediately knew that we had to go on the attack no matter what the consequences. After the first announcement of the investigations into us, in effect, it said to all four of us that you are not allowed to tell anyone, even in your branch, about this. Within the space of 12 hours, we ignored it at conference and produced material. We have campaigned throughout the whole course of this union. We have taken a view. There's no guarantee of what the outcome of our situation will be, but whatever happens, they will know that they have been in a fight, and they will know that they have been in a battle. Unfortunately for the bureaucracy, that we have been able to kick up such a fuss to embarrass them in front of the whole of the Labour movement, not just a question inside our trade union. And that ability, in effect, of going out publicly campaigning, not thinking that you can win it, has given us the opportunity to politically raise the issue. It is incredible, in many senses, that we were attacked on the issue of alleged racism, a trumped-up charge, not new to those in our organisation from the days of militant. But off the back of that, what did we do on the NEC elections? One of the first black women NEC members elected via party was a comrade from us in the teeth of a charge against racism. Off the back of the witch hunt, we doubled our party numbers from 3 to 6 on the national executive, whilst the other left, in effect, have lost seats on the national executive. And we've been able to take the campaign into the branches and into our own members, and not an easy debate at this point in time. How do you explain to your ordinary members in my branch and others, at the time you're calling for them to fight, join the union, fight job cuts and fight attacks, when they know that the union is stabbing you in the back at the same time? And we have been able, although albeit difficult at times, to politically educate many of the members about what this issue is at this moment in time, and it was because we have taken that battle up that we have been able, in my opinion, to survive and stay this long. And it's not over yet. We have the appeals. I had my appeal last week, and the other comrades are over the next few weeks, and the last in January. We are now about to launch a new element of the campaign, calling for an independent inquiry inside the union into the allegations made by those full-time officials, of what are unelected full-time officials doing. On the 8th of December, we've got a meeting in Parliament with John McDonald's agreed to lay down an early day motion in support for this independent inquiry, a lobby of the National Executive. And we've warned that, in effect, if Unison refuse to call an independent inquiry, then we may have to look at doing it ourselves, approaching some friendly other national trade union leaders, Chris, about whether they'd be prepared, I mean that jokingly about you here, by the way, would be prepared to do that question. Because we have got no intention of going anywhere quietly. We have our court case, of course, in in December, and now is an open question of whether Unison will lose that. There was a decision in court, some of you may have seen just last week, that in effect now has the court has ruled that the communist, Marxist and socialist, which it says in the rule, in unusual words for a high court to judge to use, can be classed as a philosophical belief, which is news to anyone sat in this room, but for British courts it's a new thing, that in effect now Unison is in trouble. And in that court case, they have been throwing in accusations that we're now entrants into the trade union. Their own barrister listed, in effect, the names of every Trotskyist in our four branches under attack. How did he know that if it wasn't for the fact that they were literally monitoring the activists during the course of the court case? We've got emails between national officers that are openly monitoring the Socialist Party webpage, the Socialist Party newspaper, and sending links to each other about, have you seen this on the witch hunt inside the Socialist, etc. And the final two comments that I want to make. During the course of this, and it's an issue for all of the trade unions, the issue of a democratic programme, democratic control of all of our leaders in the trade union, is as vital today as it was yesterday. It's an area that Chris will undoubtedly deal with, because it isn't just over once you've won the leadership. The whole issue of accountability, democratic control of our leadership is extremely important, as is the question of left organisations within the trade unions. Relatively, across some of the unions in Britain are weak. We have the appalling situation, in my opinion, but Kevin may have a different view, inside Unite, for instance. They can have a national broad left conference when there are more full-time officials in the room than there are rank-and-file activists. Now, I have no problem about them turning up, but they shouldn't be controlling those sorts of organisations. And it is the need for organised, disciplined lefts within the trade unions that are critical, that can hold to account its leadership that it elects. And also we see the dangers that it don't. Remember Aslef and Mick Ricks, a left general secretary elected overnight and went overnight as quickly. And why? Because he had no organised force beneath him, no force built beneath him, and the right wing quickly can organise. Because it is a truism that there is no final settlement, even in the battle against trade union bureaucracies, until, in effect, we achieve a complete victory. Comrades, I am confident in the battle that we have waged, we have politically already won. No matter what the outcome for us individually, that even the results that they've given, a 3-year ban, by the way, obviously an appalling decision, but in the scheme of expulsions and 8-year bans just being dished out, it shows the timidity that they were of taking on our party, and they view us as different. I'm absolutely confident that the reason for their attacks is over fear of knowing what's coming. The tide is turning with us, and the tide of the membership is the need for a militant and fighting trade unions. Thanks very much. Come on.
Thanks very much, Glenn. The next speaker is Chris Buff, who, as I said, is Assistant General Secretary of the PCS, speaking in a personal capacity, but it wasn't so long ago, only a few years ago, that the PCS and its forerunner, the CPSA, was in the hands of an extreme right-wing clique. And since then, socialists and the left have been able to get over socialist ideas and policies and tactics for that union and transform that union. So Chris is going to explain a little bit about that and also how you can change other unions. Chris.
Okay. Well, I mean, thanks for the opportunity to say a few words. And I think kicking off, really, with the fact that the bureaucratic would say that there are certain protocols that you're required to observe when you're a national elected officer. And I say that in the sense that open calls for one national officer in one union to be organising to depose my counterparts in another union is regarded, it's a sort of unofficial protocol, is regarded as a sort of a breach of and regarded as an interference in the internal affairs of another union. In the same way as the Bridlington Agreement was an agreement within the TUC to ensure that unions weren't getting into poaching wars. And the Memorandum of Understanding that Glenn, interestingly enough, refers to, that we've signed with Unison, is a recognition of the fact that both unions are now bound to avoid poaching of members, and that if there is an overlap where there's a legitimate debate and discussion to be had about which union is best placed to represent a particular block of workers, both unions are required to follow the process of discussion and reach agreement. Now, having said all that, the first point I want to make is that you don't need to be a member of the Socialist Party. In fact, you don't even need to be a socialist to recognise what a gross abuse of power we're seeing in Unison now in attacking good comrades like Glenn and Kaz, which is, not only is it a slur on their record of activity, but it is quite blatantly a breach of anybody's natural justice. And I think, you know, as Glenn has said, that, I mean, in Unison, probably the worst, one of the worst culprits, and I always find this quite interesting, that it's become almost like a generic term of abuse, that you're a trot. Now, in Unison, it's a pretty elastic term. It's anybody that mildly criticises the leadership, anybody that organises against the leadership. And it has become a sort of almost term of abuse. And I find it quite ironic and interesting, in fact, that a Russian-born revolutionary of 1879, who leads a revolution in Russia, who gets ousted, spends time in Turkey, then Norway, declares himself a citizen of the planet without a passport. The only country that will have him is Mexico, as a result of lobbying by Rivera and a number of artists. He then gets assassinated in 1940. And what is astonishing to me in some ways is that this guy still has a resonance in the British Labour movement in 2009. And my point is that, and it's an interesting feature of the crash and the debate about the way forward now, that it's rekindled an interest in the ideas of Marxism. And I think that there is a genuine fear and foreboding in the, on the part of the ruling class, that more and more people will gravitate to the body of ideas which provide an explanation of the workings of capitalism. I mean, I think all comrades would acknowledge capital is not one of the lightest reads, but it provides a illuminating and still absolutely scientifically valid analysis of the nature, even now, of modern capitalism. It provides a means of understanding the sort of sweep of history through the writings around historical materialism, and it provides a philosophical take on the natural world and our place within it. But the beauty of Marxism, and the reason why Marxism continues to be attacked, is that it's not just a question of a body of ideas adding to the sort of common treasury of human knowledge. In what I would regard as one of the best political sound bites ever written, philosophers have hitherto interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. And that is really the power of Marxism. It provides a means of analysis. It recognises the importance of a theoretical understanding but it is a guide to action. It's about providing the means of developing a method. And that brings you to a number of quotes and interesting writings by Trotsky in the 30s. There's a number of articles that summarise the discussions he was having with a number of American Trotskyists at that particular time, and it was about how to intervene in trade unions. And I'll just give a couple of quotes. This was one that a comrade, a full-timer, showed me. This would be about 1989, and the quote was that impatient leftists sometimes say that it's absolutely impossible to win over the trade unions because the bureaucracy uses the organisation's internal regimes for preserving its own interests, resorting to the basest machinations, repressions and plain crookedness in the spirit of rotten boroughs. And he poses the question, well, why waste time and energy? But of course, it leads you on to the point that socialists stand in the front line of all kinds of struggles, even when they involve only the most modest material interests of democratic rights of the working class, again emphasising the importance of how we intervene in unions. And Trotsky said, by strengthening the unions, we seek to renew the top leadership of the unions boldly and resolutely in critical moments, advancing new militant leaders in place of routine functionaries and careerists. Now, the reason why those quotes are close to my heart is that, as I've said, we were in 1989, there was a period where the broad left in CPSA had a year in office. And it's interesting that the 1988 anti-union legislation constituted an imposition on unions to conduct all elections for the General Secretary and National Executive under postal balloting. And those were the first set of elections in CPSA under the new postal balloting regulations. And the left lost every single seat. We were wiped out in those elections. The margin between the right and the left wasn't that great, but we lost every seat. And there was a real sense of defeat and pessimism on the part of the broad left. And there was, interestingly enough, that at the press conference that was called by the government, when they announced the new legislation, Norman Tebbit was asked, well, why are you going, have you introduced this new form of voting in internal union elections? Why have you introduced postal balloting and made it a legal requirement? Norman Tebbit, in response to a question from a journalist, highlighted the need to set up voting systems within unions that prevent a repetition, that prevent the election of people like Arthur Scargill and the election of the left in the CPSA. And again, we now know that was a blatant intervention of the state. Postal balloting is an encouragement to an armchair form of trade unionism. It disconnects the membership from the activists and increases the hand of the bureaucracy to impose its particular view. Now, my point is that at that time there was a real sense that the right wing seemed to be in an impregnable position. That they were, I think it's fair to say, one of the most right-wing leaderships in the trade union movement. We established that they had formal links to a whole series of state organisations, one dubious-sounding body called the Trade Union and Labour Committee for Transatlantic and European Understanding. And this was a document. This was an organisation that Ringsbottom and Marion Chambers was a member of. And it had Suarez in Portugal, who was found to have CIA links, a number of AFL-CIO officials that were known to have links to the security services, an international body that was about protecting the interests of American imperialism. And the reason we knew about this is that a recruitment letter was inadvertently circulated to one of our comrades, inviting the leadership of the CPSA to meet the Labour attaché at the US Embassy, a Vice Admiral Crow. And again, it gives you an indication of the people that they were rubbing shoulders with. But my point here is that they never succeeded in destroying the power of the conference. A combination of one of the most right-wing leaderships in the British trade union movement, and the successive industrial impact of Thatcher in seeking to pick fights with individual unions, to undermine the power of unions. We all know that unions were identified before they were even elected as an obstacle to the neoliberal project. The civil service strike in 81, NHS strike, miners strike, the printers. All of this was set out in the famous or infamous Ridley Plan, drawn up in 1978. But the point is that a combination of a very right-wing leadership and the attacks from Thatcher, but most importantly the subjective influence of Militant and the Socialist Party, enabled us to develop a broad left that in many respects is, you know, it would be rash or arrogant for anybody in the CPSA or the former CPSA or PCS to suggest that you could automatically apply all of the lessons in all of the unions. But there are some, I think, some important lessons that we were able, we played an absolutely critical role in developing a broad left on the basis of unity around an industrial and political programme. And those were about the need to restore national pay bargaining, for a national fight against the job cuts, about a national fight to prevent the steady sort of speed up of the work process that all areas of the public and private sector have encountered over the course of the last nearly three decades. So we were able to develop agreement around an industrial and political programme that united activists within the whole of the, all the best activists. But the second element, and again this touches on the battle in Unison in many other unions, is the question of union democracy. That the, who controls the union? And now that is a battle that starts from the workplace upwards. It's about controlling your regional officials. It's about controlling, making sure that you can get your motions and demands even on the conference agenda. I mean, in many unions, it's a battle to even get your motions printed. And it's interesting, I cite a little example in the CPSA. There was a rule 10-4 in our constitution that the right wing said if there were adverse legal consequences inherent in any motion, then they could remove it from the conference agenda. But of course, they would simply say, so you'd submit your motion, and it could be about anything, criticising the leadership, it could be about an industrial issue. If they didn't want it heard, they'd just whisk it off the agenda. So of course, we then say, well, what were the legal grounds? And they go, well, we've got legal advice that says it has adverse legal consequences. We go, well, can you tell us? No. Can we see the legal advice? No. You'll have to take it from us that it has adverse legal consequences. The reason I highlight that is that in order to counteract it, not only did we build up pressure, circulate the motions and demands, not only did we campaign at the conference itself and highlight this attempt by the bureaucracy to remove the motions, we worked with a number of sympathetic lawyers who would scrutinise the motions or any rule amendment, and we got to the point where we were tabling motions to the National Executive Committee and the Standing Orders Committee, accompanied by a lawyer's letter that said, if you remove this, we will seek an injunction to prevent the conference proceeding because you don't have the legal basis for doing this. Now, I simply say that was an example. It's not bestowing any great hopes and dreams on the bourgeois legal system, but I simply highlight that as one of the intricate tactical things that have to be done sometimes in the battle against people that want to stifle genuine debate within the trade union movement. Now, I think that, you know, it was a battle over a number of years. You know, there was no shortcut to this from our point of view. And, you know, a number of comrades were facing witch hunts, most notably at Newcastle, where they tried to expel eight of our comrades, again on trumped up charges. I think the difference here is that in the CPSA rulebook, you had an automatic right of appeal to the National Conference, and we were able to win the argument and the vote at the National Conference. That's not a democratic right that exists within Unison, which is another, which poses all sorts of additional tactical difficulties for our comrades within Unison. But I think my basic point here is that, and I think this is the experience not just in the CPSA, but from the point at which unions became functioning bodies where there was a developed trade union bureaucracy, to some extent a necessary evil, but nevertheless, when unions became durable, lasting institutions, the tradition, not just in the UK, but across the Western world, is that it is the union bureaucracy, as Trotsky described, almost becomes assimilated and incorporated as part of the state. And again, I think he describes this as the a key task for all socialists remains the liberation of the workers from the reactionary influence of trade union bureaucracy. Now, we eventually, so the election of Janis Godrich as president and Mark Sawatka as general secretary and a left leadership did not come overnight, is my point. It was the product of many, many years' activity by many, many comrades on the receiving end of many, many attacks by a vicious right-wing leadership. But a combination of factors, and my point here is the critical role of socialists and Marxists and the methods that can be deployed to develop a left unity, an approach on the basis of left unity. And I think that this, in many ways, is the topical debate for the left in general. It doesn't just apply in developing lefts in individual unions. The same principles and discussions are required in developing a new workers' party, in pulling together the forces of the left and developing a genuine working class alternative to the mainstream political parties. And I suppose my concluding points here are that, you know, there are no shortcuts. The sign that comrades are starting to have an influence within the union, the most obvious sign, unfortunately, is the union bureaucracy start using their own power to stifle debate and use disciplinary measures. But the fact is that members, the trade union movement, it's taken something of a battering over the last three decades, but there's one thing about the UK trade union movement. It may not be prone to the sort of rapid movements and going out onto the street from a French perspective, but the British trade union movement is the oldest in the world, and arguably it's one of the most resilient. And despite the attacks, the bombardment that it's received over the last 20-30 years, it's still just short of 7 million strong. And we've seen recently just a flavour of the enormous latent power that the trade union movement has around the pensions issue, where again 3 million public sector workers secured the most important industrial gain for the British trade union movement in the Blair Brown years. 3 million workers threatening to go on strike, concentrated mines, and as the Financial Times described it, Blair surrenders on public sector pensions. That ought to go be handed to some members of the Socialist Workers' Party that can't see a significant gain when it jumps out at them. But that just gave a flavour, as has the action around Lindsay, with our comrades playing an absolutely pivotal role, the occupations at Vistian, the action at Vestas. All of this is just giving a flavour of the enormous latent power. And I would say that if the Unison leadership were going to be successful, they'd have had a go at Glenn and a number of other comrades a few years ago. Not at the point when increasing numbers of Unison members, aligned with the rest of the trade union movement and the working class, are looking to the unions as the first and last line of defence in the face of one of the biggest attacks that the working class will have encountered, certainly since the 1930s. So my message really is hopefully an optimistic one, in that despite the methods that these characters can sometimes resort to, I think the combination of our methods of confidence combined with the fact that the class are looking increasingly to the trade union movement to provide protection, and we can provide a political leadership to harness the enormous latent power that has only been revealed, certainly since, has not really been revealed to some extent, since perhaps 84 and the 1970s. But it's a power that remains, and our comrades can play an absolutely pivotal role in harnessing that, in intervening, in influencing the politics of the new generation of trade union activists that will come forward. And let's not hear any nonsense about people that aren't interested in unions. Young people aren't interested in unions. And I cite an example in our own union. It's a modest, but I think an important sign of what is possible. We've got one of the most vibrant young members' networks of any trade union. And because we've opened up the structures, because we've encouraged activism, within the PCS. We've shown that young people will join, will become active within the trade union movement. You know, the single biggest reason why young people have never joined a union, as shown in the TUC report, is because nobody's ever asked them. And again, I think the trade union movement has a massive responsibility, and we can play an absolutely pivotal role in influencing that. So thanks for listening, comrades.